Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're listening from, and welcome to 1% Better, the podcast where we take a look at hidden stories in sports. I'm Zalan Funake, and joining me, as always, Dr. David Lipman. David, how are you?
I'm well, mate. How are you going?
I'm doing very well. I was hating you yesterday in your capacity as my coach, doing another overdressed run, 15Ks. You haven't lived in the Southern Hemisphere for a very long time, so you do not know what 26 degrees at 3 p.m. in the afternoon feels like. And you're making me running in multiple layers, long pants. Man, my running partner I was running with the Biokinetics. She was like, are you nuts? You look like you've just jumped into a river.
Yeah, well, we'll talk, you know, next, you know, in a couple of weeks, we'll have an episode with Jamie Stanley. So he's kindly agreed to come on the podcast. We are releasing that. So for those listeners in, you know, interested in the heat episode, it is coming. This week we got to the Super Shoes episode, obviously, and in a couple of weeks' time we'll do the heat episode. So do stay tuned. Of course, subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss that when it does come out. And I'm excited to talk to Jamie about it, and I'm excited for you to run Comrades and smash it and go, oh, it was great. What are you talking about? So
I'll hold you to that. I'll at the 70K mark, I'll say, he said it was going to be great. Doesn't feel so great right now. talking about running, you are running as well. You're about to hop on a plane to New York, and you are doing the Brooklyn Half.
Yeah, so I teased a couple of weeks ago that I had a race coming up. So we're running the Brooklyn Half the day after this was released. So it'll be Saturday morning, Brooklyn time, New York time. They're slightly similar, Brooklyn and New York, their time. So yeah, running that with Jonah Rosner and a few others there. So that'll be really fun. Finishing the Coney Island Boardwalk. I'm real excited. And we'll see what happens. I'm not sure. Like, we were talking offline before. You sort of said, well, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I'll decide whether I pace Jonah, which will be close to my max at the moment anyway, or whether I run a true max and see what happens. I'll see how I'm feeling, obviously having got off a plane the day before because I'm flying Friday. So we'll see. But if there are any listeners down there and they want to come say hello, try and find me. I'll good luck. It's going to be a big race. So yeah.
I'm excited to see you racing again, putting on a number again after the injuries and mishaps you've had. So super cool to see, and looking forward to seeing how that goes. I'm also excited about this episode. We talked to Michael Nitschke. How many shoes do you need? If you think David is a geek when it comes to running shoes, wait until you hear this interview. Unbelievable. His insight was just mad.
I can tell you comfortably as well that Nitta owns more shoes than you and I combined, probably by a factor of two still.
I mean, he was just pulling them up. He was just pulling one shoe up after the other. And unfortunately, the podcast isn't video, but we are going to cut up those clips and put them up on our social media channel. So check out 1% Better Pod on Instagram, because he was just like a lecture, pulling up these shoes, explaining what they were, how you use them. It's just unbelievable, man. So we'll get to that in a second. Before we do, I want to thank our sponsor for this podcast, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Thank you so much for your support. A product we believe in, a product we use, they are absolutely unbelievable. We do have a discount code on your first purchase, 15% off on your first purchase. Put in 1% Better Podcast, or go to the show notes. There's a direct link there that'll take you there in the show notes. There's also the Precision Fuel and Hydration Planner to help you plan your next race and tell you exactly how much you should be eating, what you should be eating. Super cool tool there. David, should we get to some community shout outs?
Yeah, we'll keep these shout outs short and the episode outside of the interview with Nitta short, because it was a long interview, and I think, you know, people enjoy the brevity of these episodes, so we won't do too much before then. So no doctor's office this week, and we won't do anything that's come across my desk. That'll be for next week. But first thing is, you got a DM to our social accounts. Obviously, Zylan runs our social accounts, everybody. So that's why they're not as funny as they could be. What was the DM, mate?
We got a message in from Cole. He says, David and Zylan, or Zylan and David, LOL. He's already funnier than I am. He says, love all that you've done with the rebranding. I think it looks great, and I love the sleek look, and really been enjoying the episodes recently. Cole, we'll answer your question. You don't have to butter us up this much, man. Just get to the question. He says, as a little update from our last exchange, I've decided to go forward with medical school and I'll be attending it in the fall. I also participated in my first triathlon. It was a local sprint distance and I got third in my age group. However, that was just in prep for my A race, which is an Ironman 70.3 this weekend. And as I'm sat here on taper, I had a couple of questions come to mind that could be interesting to discuss. The first one was, how do you adjust nutrition on a taper period, if at all? I'm burning considerably less with the reduced volume, but my appetite is still there, and I know I've been in a sizable surplus for most of this two-week taper. I haven't read much into the literature on this, so it could be curious to hear your thoughts. The second part of the question we're going to get to in the next episode, but David, do you want to touch on the taper?
Yeah, firstly, congratulations, Cole. For context for listeners, he'd reached out and sort of asked for some thoughts and advice around med school and whether he should enter. So we gave him that and, you know, he's ended up entering. So congratulations, Cole. It's an exciting part of life. I remember the feeling very well. I think the advice I give to all students is make sure you keep up your self-care routine, be that sleep, training, all that stuff. So that's the first bit. In terms of taper, I think, so first things first, most of what everybody burns energy-wise is as a result of your basal metabolic rate and what's required to live, right? That is, even the most elite athletes, 30 hours a week of training, still the majority of the energy they burn is not to do with training. So classically, they'd say for people like you and I, Zylan, it's around 60 to 70%. If you're very sedentary, if you don't do a lot of exercise, maybe it's 80% of your total energy is just what it requires for you to sort of exist, right? And then a little bit of movement around. Then there's a portion of energy which is quite small, depending on your diet, and that'll vary a little bit, but it's not going to vary significantly, maybe 1 or 2%, which relates to the energy required to burn food, right? It's the part no one talks about. So that you know, digestion, all that stuff requires energy, and that's usually, they say, about 10%. I don't know. Depends on the processing your diet, et cetera, et cetera. Then the rest is activity. Now, that activity can, you know, obviously shrink and expand. If you do no exercise, it's obviously not that much. And if you do 30 hours a week, it's a lot more. But proportionally, it is still a small proportion compared to what it costs you to live, right? So I guess what I'm getting at there is, A, it's not as big a proportion as most people think. And B, therefore, you still need to keep your intake up. And perhaps the thought experiment I would do for you is, what happens if you really go strict on your diet for 2 weeks? How much weight do you lose? Answer is not much, because it's only 2 weeks, right? And I would say the same thing of 2 weeks of a little bit less activity and eating a normal amount. So I would not stress too much on it. I've actually never really thought this question through before Cole asked it, because generally I'd say you're in a recovery mode. So eating as much as you need is fine. And again, you're not going to put on much weight in 2 weeks. If anything, you're replenishing some stores and some ongoing deficits, and you'll be better off on race day. You're still going to be exercising a bit in taper, so you still need to refuel a little bit. And I wouldn't be too worried about it. I wouldn't be going to increase my intake, although in the carbohydrate loading phase, in that sort of 24, 48, maybe 36 hours, I'd be bumping carbohydrate intake up, but not necessarily total energy, although that will probably happen as a byproduct. But other than that, just sort of exist and eat to hunger, and I think you'd be fine. I wouldn't be too worried about not doing too much, because, yeah, it's still, you're still using a lot of energy. You're probably thinking about the race, and the brain is a surprisingly energetically heavy tool. So, yeah.
Am I correct in saying I would definitely not be focused on losing weight in those 2 weeks leading up to the race? It's better to put on weight than to lose weight.
You shouldn't be thinking about losing weight. End of discussion. No questions asked. Will you put on weight? You might do, because you're replenishing glycogen stores, storing some water, doing those things. But yeah, I don't think it's significant. I don't think if we did a DEXA scan and really looked at body composition and those sort of things, I don't think you'd be putting on fat in that period. I just don't think that's going to happen. And again, some of this will depend on individual physiology. Some of us gain weight easier than others, and some of us don't gain weight. We've all got that friend who metabolically like can eat whatever they want and they're still very lean. And conversely, there are people more like me, to be honest, where body fat is something that you accumulate a lot easier. So you probably need to be a touch more careful than some others.
Yeah, and I get my body fat from you. I'm the same as you. I pick it up very quickly. I just, whenever we get on a call, I pick up weight. I just have to walk past a restaurant and smell what they're cooking, and I am 300 grams heaviest.
Having seen your diet at camp, I disagree with that. I think it's a lot of it's to do with you, mate, and the choices you're making.
Being bullied. I mean, we're 10 minutes into this and the bullying has started. But Cole, we love you being a super fan of this podcast. Thank you so much for that DM on Instagram. Keep them coming, and we'll get to the other parts of your question in the next episode. But for now, we have to get to another wild, exciting, amazing part of this episode. I just geeked out, absolutely loved it, and I have no doubt that you are going to love it as well. So after our Super Shoes episode a month ago, we had a few questions about shoes in general, and we were planning to reach out to our guest anyway, so it made good sense to get him on board for this, given he's the perfect person for this episode. We're really excited about this. Michael Nitschke is a practicing podiatrist and partner at the Sports and Arthritis Clinic in Adelaide, a certified sports podiatrist and level 2 advanced running coach focusing on middle and long distance events. He's currently coaching the Adelaide Milers crew with some of South Australia's most promising junior runners under his tutelage. In addition to clinical work, Michael teaches anatomy as well as running injuries and athletic footwear at the University of South Australia. Beyond this, he has conducted research through Adelaide University into the training characteristics of runners. Most commonly known as Nedda, some listeners may also recognize him as the co-host of Shoe Geeks, as part of the Inside Running podcast network, where he discusses shoes to great levels of detail. An impressive runner himself, Nedda has run 15593 in the 800 meter, 35908 in the metric mile, 1501 in the 5000 meter, and has a 2:33:35 marathon. And he's also got a long history in the pro running scene in Australia, having won the Bay Sheffield 550 meter, and something apparently only Australians will know, has placed third in the Starwell Gift 800 meter. Michael, welcome to the podcast, man.
That was a mouthful. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you taking the time, given all that schedule, Nitta. And, you know, been a bit of a while coming, so really appreciate you and appreciate your time. I guess for listeners, to get some context, and I know some of this backstory, it's an awesome one. How did you get into sport? Let's start there.
Look, I grew up on a farm in a place called Loxton in the Riverland, so a cereal farm. So to put things in perspective, I lived on the South Australian and Victorian border. My dad, pure cereal farmer, we lived on 10,000 acres of land. And we, you know, each day was sort of a bit of a walk or a drive or a bike ride to the bus stop, and then a 45-minute bus stop ride to the school in Loxton, and then back home each day. Actually, I was sort of saying, driving past a bus stop the other day, seeing all the kids with their faces in iPhones, I remember I used to get all my study done on a 45-minute bus trip on the way home each day. So by the time I was home, I was, you know, ready to be pretty active. But look, I got into sport because I was really interested in, like, growing in a country area, your social networks came from general sports. I was like every other kid in the country who was interested in football and basketball, and no specific sort of training for one sport more than another. But when I got to about 13, 14, I preferred track and field the most. High jump and sort of the longer sprints were my two events. So I jumped well, and I preferred sort of events like 200 through to 800 meters. And then our school was, you know, I guess relative to the country region around, we were quite good at athletics. So I had an interest in being able to run. And I think as I got to year 11 and year 12, and I was focusing a little bit more on study and a bit less on other sports, running was just a really accessible sport. At that point in time, I already had a bit of obsession in shoes and things like that, which we could probably get into in a bit as well. I still remember like the initiation of my first couple pairs of shoes and how it evolved so quickly, like when I got to year 11 and 12 with technology and shoes. And that interest took me towards more like lower leg injury and pathology. Selfishly enough, I ended up picking podiatry just out of the own curiosity of trying to fix a few of my own ailments, I think. And that led me to the interest of, you know, lower limb biomechanics, sports injury, and just sustainable running, if that makes sense.
But that can't just be it, Nitta. You can't just have been a little curious and then gone into podiatry. Like, how does the son of a cereal farmer, like, go and do a medical degree like that?
Yeah. Look, both my brothers are farmers. Recently, my middle brother's taken over the main farm. Dad still works. He's still in great health. And, you know, I think when I was really young, I was super interested in the farm. And I think when I got to about 14, 15 and 16, I was a bit above average in sports. So, like, I would feature at state titles in 400s and 800s and things like that. That was a three-hour drive for me to get to athletics. So it was, you know, more arduous to get there. And so every time I'd, you know, there'd be a bit more pressure to put on myself to do well at those events. And I think the inevitable solution was to try and move to a location where athletics is more accessible as well. But I actually was only a three-year degree. I don't know what it was like for you, Dave, but I was a three-year bachelor degree through UniSA. I had the secondary school scores to get into physiotherapy, but I was just so much more interested in lower leg related injury. I think medial tibial stress syndrome is the first thing that I probably had at the age of 16, a big change in training load and things like that. And not knowing that was the cause as a 16-year-old, you know, you think you can have a quick fix and, you know, no one's willing to hear that, you know, you need to be able to modify your training characteristics to be able to sort your problem. So I used to think things like, you know, certain shoes and certain materials beneath my foot could solve my problems. So the interest really began there. And that was a pretty firm interest even at the age of 16 and 17. So
that sounds so much like my story. And, you know, there's a reason we got on so well when we first met. I mean, I was running, you know, a little bit further than you because I was a lot slower than you. I was running sort of 8s and 15s. Again, 15, 16, got medial tibial stress syndrome, more commonly known as shin splints, saw a podiatrist. He was a very good podiatrist. Mm. I wanted to be him. And so I ended up in that and also running in, you know, it kind of did solve my problems because my foot stopped moving. I went into an orthotic and Brooks Beast. For those who may remember, that's probably the, you know, an appropriately named shoe. This thing was, it was big. It's a really interesting period of footwear there, really, and concepts in running. I guess let's just touch on quickly. You mentioned.
Do you remember your first shoe?
My first running shoe, proper one. Yeah, I do. It was the Asics 2070s.
Oh, nice.
And it was one of my favorite shoes. Actually, I don't know if I like that. I've got a list of my favorite shoes, and we can talk favorite shoes later, Nina. But what was yours? I think I've heard some of this. You started running in basketball shoes, didn't you?
No. You remember the Asics Tiger Touch? You still see them as a casual shoe now. They're like a touch footy shoe, but they were like a, you know, half suede material upper, a rippled outsole, one piece outsole, thin EVA foam, probably 50, 60 points of durometer, maybe higher to be honest, but it was pretty versatile. You know, could run, jump and throw in it. But I remember that shoe specifically because yeah. I know like the second pair that I got was, you know, I grew out of the first pair and the second pair I got was just, I loved it so much. I bought a pair, but my size wasn't available. So I ended up getting a shoe that was like two sizes too big for me because I wanted the specific shoe still. Didn't work, of course. And then my first shoe transition was actually to the Asics GT 2050s, which was a really polarizing shoe change for me from the Tiger Touch to the GT. So that was, for me, that was like, oh, why am I wearing this shoe for support? It was real dramatic change. That got my interest. I was about 13 years of age, about year eight.
Yeah, it's a little bit before I started. But so you've talked about sustainable running. Talk to us a little bit about your research because I was a research subject here. I'm interested in sort of where it ended up. I don't think I ever found out too much like where it ended up, but I'm interested in why did you study what you studied in your research and then sort of where has it ended up and what have you learned?
Look, we're still in that phase now. Data's been collected. Like the whole idea was to look at training characteristics of recreational runners. And ironically enough, we utilized, the park run, you would have seen all this, they've removed all the scoreboards and times and leaderboards, et cetera. We actually use park run like sub 17 and sub 20 as this sort of like high performing recreational runner standard because everyone was aware of it. And then people on the other side of that. And we followed the training characteristics of runners for a block of around about 26 weeks and injury risk as well. And you know as well as I know that there seems to be this association between really sustainable runners tend to collect a lot more duration of weekly training. And it's sometimes the magic's in just being able to handle more training. And how you actually handle more training is usually distributing your effort through the week or your intensity to allow that. And that's a bit different for every person. And the hypothesis was perhaps maybe, all recreational runners, and we've had some small papers on this show that People often who run a bit less often regress to the mean with controlling their intensity. And perhaps that might be part of the reason why we see, you know, common running related injury ailments as well, part of the feature of not being able to handle as much training, like medial tibial stress syndrome, patellofemoral pain. And look, we're still in the point of like, I mean, I have about 40 runners in our running group at the Adelaide University Athletics Club as well. And we still track their data now. And you definitely see these characteristics when people first begin running. There is this, you know, natural tendency unable to separate hard and easy as you would when you've been doing the sport for a long period of time. So whether that's purely because they don't have the physiological attributes to be able to do that, or they don't have the intuition to be able to do that, well, I'm not 100% sure. I guess they're the answers we're trying to find out. So, but in relation to running more, usually the answer is, you know, you can do a lot more when you control the intensity, you'll spend more time at the lower intensity. And definitely the early onset of that data shows the people that were training a lot more higher dose consequently spent a lot more time on their relatively low intensity. And when I say lower intensity, relative to them. So, you know, the metrics we use were obviously pace, RPE scales to match up. And heart rate data was relatively insignificant because people sometimes use heart rate straps and wrist straps, and it's quite skewed, as you'd be aware.
Yeah. That heart rate's a bit of a bogey for people if you're not sure what they're using. But so that makes a ton of sense. Just to confirm here, basically what you're seeing is that the more recreational runners are running pretty similarly at all times, similar sort of intensity at all times, whereas as they gain experience and collect more mileage, they tend to polarized towards like a hard, easy split, whatever metric you want to use there for, like the line doesn't really matter, but it's more like they sort of moderate their intensity more. And by virtue of that, just by volumes increasing, you have to do more low intensity, right? You just, it's probably the ceiling of high intensity is pretty low. And probably everybody is doing a similar amount of high intensity. As you collect volume, it's just more low intensity stuff for the most part, until you get to like maybe the elite level where you can sustain a little bit more high intensity, but it's still only ever going to be, you know, 20 to 30 kilometers a week. It's never going to be much more than that at most.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
Ned, I wanted to ask you earlier, you mentioned that when you were in year 11 and year 12, you saw a big evolution in running shoes. I mean, the last 5-6 years, I would say we've obviously seen like the rise of the super shoe, and we've seen the industry completely change. But let's go back into that time, year 11, year 12. What sort of evolution did you see in shoes back then?
Look, my experience was the example of the Tiger Touch. It was a single durometer midsole with a one sheet rippled outsole with a, you know, a suede upper on top. So quite simple shoe, you know, probably weighed 200 grams. It was relatively versatile. You'd almost call it a performance trainer, but a thin sheet foam. But the first transition I made into a shoe was the GT 2050s. And back then, a lot of footwear companies were diving into using characteristics in shoe to try and modify things for injury risk, more than likely. So this shoe had a double density posting that actually originated from the forefoot and went all the way back to the central part of the midsole. So if you wore the shoe out because you couldn't compress the medial part of the foam, what would happen is that as the shoe lifespan started to increase, the shoe would slowly become more inverted because you compressed the lateral side of the shoe a lot more because the foam was less dense and the medial side. So it actually become like an inverted shoe over time. Most shoes from the time frame, so that was about before 2000. That was about 1998 through to 2003 at that point. Most shoes used a double density posting or a trussex or a plastic model to try and accommodate a pronatory based model of trying to decrease risk of injury. And you would try and connect the person with a foot posture that required that attribute. For me at that age, obviously, I didn't understand that was something that was, you know, worthwhile. I didn't get injured as a young person, so the shoe change didn't make a lot of sense. But for someone that weighed probably 40 kilos at the time, you know, prepubescent, you know, middle distance runner, wearing a shoe that probably weighed close to 400 grams, it definitely didn't like match the profile of the shoe that I would enjoy at the time. But that became the general running volume shoe for probably the next 5-10 years for me, other variants of different brands, but that was the norm. And then you would seek a lightweight shoe specifically for racing. But racing shoes back then, a lightweight racing shoe isn't a lightweight racing shoe now. The evolution in recent times has first been the change in the racing performance shoes. And the second thing has been, now we're starting to find those attributes fall into the daily trainer as well now. And that's changed the way that people perceive footwear comfort for sure.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a second. Just for listeners, the upper of a shoe is the top bit. That makes complete sense. The outsole is the sort of the grip for most people. The midsole is where most of the magic happens. That's the bit sort of between your foot and the outsole, yeah, or the grip, so to speak. The dual density, you know, historically, you know, Australian listeners particularly will remember, you know, the gray stuff on the inside of the shoe. That was basically how you could tell that there was, you know, a difference in density. And this, like, I think, and you'll speak to this, Nitto, like the prevailing thought was most people probably pronate, they probably pronate too much. Preventing pronation, you know, rolling into the feet helps prevent injury. And, you know, if you don't pronate too much, but you're in a shoe that stops it, it's not a big deal. That was kind of the prevailing thoughts. And as you well highlighted, part of the problem with this dual density type of system is that it doesn't wear evenly. So you end up with a flat shoe, and then because you've got high density on the inside, it wears unevenly, and you end up with this sitting inverted a little bit, which predisposes to other injury, but also is probably not optimal anyway.
Yep. And look, over time, that posting or that support system slowly but surely got a little bit smaller over time. It moved from being from the forefoot to the rear foot to just being strategically placed in the medial part of the foot. And now we've gone to a point where finding a medial post in a shoe is really difficult to find. Like, there's probably 3 to 4 left on the market, if that. So it's almost completely disappeared. And I've got a couple shoe samples here. I'm not sure how many people view the actual podcast or they listen to it on the run, for example. But I've got a couple shoes through here to show how the landscape of people trying to support the foot or change that has altered over time.
That'll be great, yeah. We put it up on social media, so people can see it. People can view it on our social channels. In terms of if people only can choose one pair of shoes, some of us are lucky enough. I don't know. I train in 3 or 4 pairs of shoes. If you're David and you live in a 6-bedroom house in London, you have about 25 to choose from. One for every day of the week, one for every running day of the month. But if you can only choose one shoe, how do you choose that one shoe for yourself?
Look, this is a good point. So I think at the end of the day, the first characteristic, the first thing you're looking at for picking a shoe is the purpose, first and foremost. And if you're picking one shoe, you're probably not specifically picking a shoe just for race day. That's pretty rare. You're picking a shoe to go out the door and collect between 2 to 4 runs per week at a probably that regression to the mean model of intensity. So the beauty of that now is that, like, there are plenty of shoe options that actually are available. So you walk into a retail shop in 2024 and it's just this big face of like shoes, and it's probably a little bit overwhelming for a lot of people. Where do you begin? And the answer is normally beginning with a shoe that is probably used for your daily use. You're trying to get more time out of it, like in terms of duration or durability. And then it becomes interesting because the next characteristics usually falling into how experienced you are as a runner. So usually the more experienced runner suddenly has a bit of a background and sort of what shoes they've worn historically. They have a bit more intuition to what's worked for them, just from subjective information. And they lean towards 3 or 4 shoes that they've had success with, and they start solving the puzzle more subjectively than they do objectively. The issue is if you're a novice runner, for example, is that you don't really have any of that information or that intuition. And that becomes difficult now because you have many brands offering multiple pairs of shoes at different purposes, for example. And so usually trying to direct yourself to a retailer that gives you a shoe, at least shoe education, for example, of like maybe connecting that person's body mass towards a shoe. To me, that seems to be one of the first and foremost things to be able to do. If someone's a really, really big person, they can normally usually handle a shoe that normally has more substance to it or has a higher density foam. And whereas a lightweight person probably needs a little bit less beneath their foot a lot of the time, they tend to not be able to compress the foam quite as much. So suddenly that's a variable of shoe that starts to become an important feature. Historically, the medial postings and densities and trussing systems of shoes were placed there to try and use a foot posture index or an equivalent of your connecting your foot posture to a particular type of shoe. So a pes planus or a flat foot would be connected with a shoe that had a straighter last with a higher density foam on the medial side. A really high arch foot on the other end of the scale would be connected with a shoe that's probably a little bit softer foam, a little bit more of a narrower last or more of a curved last, and perhaps maybe didn't have as many external support attributes. people still, I still would suggest that in a retail setting, that's probably still the number one way they sell shoes today, even though we know that it doesn't have a lot of evidence to reducing risk of injury. That's, they're probably still the highlighting factor. So people do categorize shoes into slightly more supportive and slightly more cushion categories still today. The difference in the categories now compared to what it was 20 years ago is that every shoe is relatively well cushioned as well now. So how they cushion the shoe is usually by increasing the midsole height of the shoe. So an example of a general jogging shoe now that's well established on the market is a shoe called like the ASICS Superblast, where the midsole of the shoe, as Dave mentioned, is the heart of the shoe, is higher off the ground, and there's a fair bit of substance beneath the foot. And the footprint or the base of the shoe has a relatively wide surface area and quite stable. And the upper of the shoe is quite simplistic. And essentially this makes a general trainer pretty safe. It makes it relatively enjoyable. And there are different degrees of categories of how high the midsole is and what type of foams they place within the heart of the midsole to change the experience as well. So this particular shoe, the foam is quite resilient. So when you hit the foam, it feels like it gives you something back. You don't feel like you're losing as much energy. And statistically, according to some evidence, you may not lose as much energy as well. Whereas some shoes will traditionally maybe be a little bit heavier. The midsole height might be a bit lower and the weight of the shoe might be a bit heavier. This shoe may be a bit more durable and it may accommodate some of the higher body mass. So this is the Kayano 31, which will be out soon. And they sort of put some attributes that still guide the foot. So this here is just another piece of foam that they've strategically placed on the medial side to try and widen the shoe up. But this foam is not quite as resilient. And I would argue that it's probably a bit less fun to run in. But for a daily trainer, for a lot of the population, people will find this probably relatively comfortable.
Awesome. And you've touched on it already there, but the way we are trying to provide support, or the way the industry is trying to provide support, has probably changed a little bit from purely using densities to more using more geometry. So the shape of the shoes, like those, the footprints of those shoes were like almost unseen. There's probably two shoes on the market, the Brooks Beast being one of them, probably the Brooks Dyad being the other one back in the 2000s, which had had such a wide midfoot.
Absolutely.
Everything else very tapered in the midfoot, and they try to put more force through it rather than creating more width there. So certainly something that's changed in the industry that I've noticed, it's an interesting thing. But so now we've got our first shoe, Nida. How do we go to a second shoe? What is that like? How does that decision go? Where do you go there?
Well, that's a good question. I think once again that comes back to the experience and the habits of the runner. I know there's some literature suggesting that when people start to reach a bit more running for the week, for example, perhaps maybe you could reduce risk of injury to some extent if you're rotating between parallel shoes. So having it, you can have the same shoe, to be honest, and rotate between the two, and your risk of injury may reduce a little bit. I think that was a 2014 study. I think it was Malio. And it makes a bit of sense to have multiple shoes. If you're lucky enough to have multiple shoes to try change the, just change some of the loading amongst the anatomy of your body. So sometimes the way the shoe influences how you hit the ground can be a bit detailed from surface, from intensity, but including also simple things like shoe geometry as well. But to keep it really simple and, relative to finances, that the second shoe that you normally pick is relative to purpose as well. If you've got a daily trainer, for example, used for easy days and longer runs, you're probably picking that shoe for your lower intensities. The second shoe, dare I say, you're advancing your running to trying to have a bit more variation, maybe increasing intensity or maybe racing and things like that as well. So you're probably picking a shoe with attributes that may lean towards that type of running. So, which brings us to shoes that are probably a bit more designed for increased intensity, where the weight of the shoe drops to try and, weight of shoe seems to be the best relationship to economy. And historically, what we saw for a lighter weight shoe for faster running used to be traditional racing flats where the midsole was really, really thin, 1 to 1.5 centimeters, a really narrow like footprint on the base of the foot.
Wow.
And
look at that.
Yep. And so this is what is that?
This is called the Prime Knit from Adidas. It was actually, they made 2012 of them in 2012 for the Olympics. So I was over in London for the Olympics in 2012, and there was this little Adidas shop selling these one piece knits. So the Prime Knit came out just before the Fly Knit, I believe. And the knitted upper was that was really the evolution of footwear at that time, was changing uppers. That there wasn't midsole changes. This was still a racing flat. And this was traditionally a shoe that you would wear for your workouts, your intervals, your quarters, your 1K repeats, your mile repeats, and sometimes your threshold runs. And that's what you would wear on race day. I still wore that for a, you know, a 10K road race back in 2012 and 13, and that was the norm. So, and you can imagine wearing a shoe like this, you know, you this is the sort of shoe you'd wear the next day. You'd wake up with sore calves and lower legs because the shoe didn't have a large fulcrum or rocker sole, which is the curve of the forefoot. It didn't have a lot of midsole, so every impact that you had to absorb had to be done or solved from the, you know, the central nervous system hitting the ground, not from the shoe dampening the effect. Whereas now this particular shoe, which I'd struggled to wear in 2022, becomes a bit more obsolete because a traditional racing flat these days looks more like this. It has a really high stack. Yeah. The footprint is a really large surface area. The midsole foam is... The one thing these two shoes have in common, though, is that the weight is still very light. In fact, this one weighs about 20 grams lighter than the Prime Knit. So the weight, you still get the advantage of, you know, improving your running from having a shoe on the base of your foot that's a bit lighter. But now you've got all the attributes of the foam that essentially you can improve economy by stiffening up the plate, creating a sagittal plane advantage of your big toe and your ankle. But also, there's got to be a benefit to being able to hit the ground with a higher impact. I mean, at the end of the day, when you run road races, hitting the ground hard is important to create force and store energy and release it. It's probably something we don't talk about enough, but I mean, you run a hard road race, for example, the ability to hit the ground hard is probably part and parcel or part of performing well.
Yeah. And then I guess
it's hard to do that in this shoe.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's probably highlights, I'd say probably the biggest technological advance we've seen in footwear, probably, yeah, I'd say probably in 10 years, if not longer, 20, maybe longer, Nitto, which is, it's people think it's all the plates, but actually the plates existed for a long time. It's not the plates, it's the foams, and the plate facilitates that foam from a structural point of view. So it's the advances in the foam,
absolutely,
which are now absolutely coming to the daily trainer as well.
Absolutely. And so, look, I mean, there was a paper from, it was Hoogkamer et al. That they used. I think it was the original Vaporfly 4%. It was the knitted one. And they put like nice slices through the midsole of the shoe through the plate. And they compared economy of the Vaporfly with the slices in it versus no slices and found that there wasn't a large economical change. So the hypothesis was a bit of magic is obviously within the foam, the store and release of it. But also perhaps maybe even simple things like increasing the lever length by being higher off the ground probably actually is an important feature for economy as well.
Yeah, and we see plates that are not single piece, right? Adidas doesn't use a plate. They use their rods and all that sort of stuff. So like it says to me that it's probably not – that the plate is probably providing some geometry and some stability to that foam because otherwise you've got a shoe like the Nike Invincible, which is still one of my favorite shoes. Which is just, it's a big old marshmallow. You've got no real stability in it. It's a big old mushy thing. So you certainly need some stability in it to really hit the ground hard and not fall everywhere.
And I think that brings us to the next point is why surface area becomes so important within the shoe. Like the ASICS Superblast is one of these daily trainers. And as you mentioned, the midsole stack heights have moved into daily trainers as an easy day shoe. But this shoe still is relatively stiff. It's responsive, but it is essentially a large resilient foam box with a really wide surface area. So it is quite stable underfoot. And it's not the foam's not quite as compliant as the Invincible. So therefore, the actual density of the foam or the slight resilience of this foam, there's still a fair bit of magic. So if I hypothetically went on and did a lab test and I found I was, you know, amongst the normal 4% economical improvement of a 4%, my guess is this particular shoe, I'd still be 2 or 3% better than compared to a traditional shoe as well.
If you're listening to this on audio, hop onto our Instagram channel. I'm going to put all of these videos up here. He's demonstrating, showing us the shoes. I feel like I'm sitting in an unbelievable lecture here. So hop onto 1% Better Pod on Instagram. We'll throw the videos up there so you get to actually see the shoes. Nitto, we spoke about choosing your first shoe, choosing your second shoe. If you were to up it and we go to like a third shoe. So for me at the moment, all my shoes expired at the same time. So I went on a shopping spree, which is why I teased David about the
rookie era.
I know. So I got the Nike Pegasus 40 that I got as sort of my, you know, Tuesday 15K running shoe. At the Two Oceans Ultra Marathon Expo, I got a really good deal on the new ASICS Nimbus 26. I got like 20% off, so I had to leave there with it.
Yeah,
I didn't have a choice. So those are the two shoes I've got at the moment. If I want to go to a third shoe, what should I start looking at?
Look, it's a good question. Like, I mean, traditionally, if you're running, the slight variations of running that we see most populations do, they might do one easy run. That might be your 10 mile that you do at a low intensity for the week. A shoe like the Nimbus, which is a relatively inoffensive shoe, nice compliant midsole, nice upper on it, relatively lightweight. You hit the ground, you don't feel the ground too much. That becomes a great recovery shoe. When you start going to longer durations of running, I find that the really compliant foams now, they don't feel the same after 1 hour as they do in the first hour, but the compliancy of the foam feels like you're getting closer to the ground. It doesn't return back as much. When I do my longer runs, I prefer the foam to be a bit more resilient. So often I'll separate my easy run shoe for less than an hour to compared to a 90-minute or two-hour running shoe where I'd wear a midsole that's slightly higher density or more responsive or more resilient foam. And that would be a variation. And last but not least is probably if I'm doing a workout of repeats and I'm doing a workout of heels or a threshold run, I still will wear a traditionally fast running shoe just to make the experience of the faster effort to be a bit easier, so to speak. And suddenly you've got a longer shoe, an easy day shoe, and a faster running shoe. That's your 1, 2, 3.
Can you give us some examples of what those shoes would be? I don't know if you have any affiliation to any brands, but can you give us some examples of what those shoes would be?
As you mentioned, the Nimbus, a traditional shoe, so similar to the Kayano, which is a stable version of the Nimbus, but relatively similar attributes. That's your daily trainer. That would be a shoe that you'd wear from, say, 0 to 60 minutes, and it'd be a pretty minimally offensive shoe. But as the duration gets longer, the weight of the shoe becomes a bit more arduous. It might not be as fun by the end. Whereas I pick up a shoe like the Super Blast, or just out of interest, like this one stopped on my doorstep. This is now the new Mizuno Neo Vista.
I want to try that so badly.
It falls in the category of the Super Blast. It's such a high midsole. The Rocker's not aggressive, but it works really well. And they put this sort of nylon plate in the midfoot. This shoe feels as good at the end of 2 hours as it does at the start of 2 hours, similar to the Super Blast, which makes this shoe an ideal pick for a long duration. Some of those attributes like the plate and the midsole do make it more comfortable, but also the weight being a bit less than those sort of Kayanos or Nimbuses make sense. And when we get to that faster running shoe, like I said originally, the weight drops again, the foam is probably a little bit more resilient, the plate's a bit more aggressive, and suddenly your ability to run at that moderate to high intensity becomes perceptually a little bit easier and physiologically a little bit easier as well. So normally if you've got this sort of range of shoes that you've got a fast day shoe, you've got like an up tempo or a longer run shoe that's you can probably hit the ground a bit harder in and it feels a bit more responsive. And then you've got your more compliant, stable, easy day running shoe. And that would be a pretty good variety of footwear through your cycle of running for the week.
Yeah. And I think from there, I mean, initially in the second shoe conversation, you sort of talked about kind of doubling for the same purpose or starting to polarize shoes a little bit, right? So it's either kind of two of the same shoe or two similar shoes, yeah. Or you start to go to something that's a little bit lighter. And I think by now at the third shoe, you've kind of got that variable in there. And then as you go to adding shoes, if you decide to do that, if you're Xylin and you decide that you just buy shoes at the drop of a hat at any festival that you go to, you end up with adding shoes for these same purposes, right? It might be more easy day shoes because, again, proportionally you're going to do more easy running than anything else.
Spot on. Yep, absolutely. And look, the durability of shoes in 2024, dare I say, would be a bit less than what it was, say, two decades ago where the foams are a lot more compliant. Probably the average body mass of people probably is a little bit higher than it was 20 years ago as well. So it probably means that the average daily trainer probably doesn't last quite as long as it used to. And look, you don't, like when you get more experienced, you know when shoes wear out. That's the question you get as a podiatrist, Dave. You know that, like, when do my shoes wear out? Like, it's a real relative question, isn't it? Like, at the end of the day, someone comes in at 100 kilos wearing an ASICS Nimbus sometimes and they hit the 4 foot only, that shoe might last 200 Ks for that person. That might be, and if you're running that, in 4 weeks, that shoe might be 4 weeks before you trade it in. So that GT 2000 I wore back when I was a kid at the age of 20, I could probably still wear that shoe now. It was so firm and so hard, you could probably get 2000 Ks out of it.
Yeah, and I think it also depend on what features really wearing out, right? So obviously outsoles are actually becoming less and less prominent, I'd say. They're certainly less durable than they used to be, and certainly less of the pure, stack is devoted to the outsole. You got a lot more minimalist outsoles happening, so absolutely. You can certainly wear through that and hit midsole quicker. You can certainly have abnormal compression from gait characteristics or shoe characteristics thing, and you end up with, I guess what used to be the case was you'd kind of wear through the outsole and that would be like the time that your shoe was done. But like, that's no longer the case. You can wear through outsoles very quickly these days. Some shoes don't have an outsole. I mentioned the Invincible doesn't really have an outsole, or it does, but it's not, it's not quite what they used to be. So
I have to tell you, a funny story. Do you guys remember the Flyknit? The it was the Epic Reacts, the first Flyknit one that got released. It sort of was like their new mileage trainer. That it was the update from the Lunar Race, and it had a bit of rubber in the forefoot and a bit in the heel, but it was completely exposed foam. And I remember, like, I would hate to be a retailer at the time, because if you went for one run in that shoe, the exposed foam shredded, and it looked like the shoe was half done after, like, you know, 10K run. But I remember running in it through a forestry the first run, and it looked like it was done. I wore that shoe for 800 kilometers, and I took a photo of it at 10 kilometers and 800 kilometers, and it looked about the same. So the exposed foam deteriorates really quickly in a visible way, but the function of the foam was pretty good for almost the whole durability of its life. So using outsole wear was really arbitrary way of, you know, working out whether your shoe was done or not, because the midsole still functioned really well. And having exposed foam as opposed to rubber makes the shoe feel a little bit softer, the noise on the ground a little bit lighter. Look, for me personally, it was a little bit more enjoyable to have more exposed foam, but still most of the population, because they came from this really heavy, durable outsole-based shoe in the previous few decades, they assumed that the shoe was probably wearing out. So the next shoe that got released was the Infinity, and the Infinity was that shoe they tried to compare to the Structure Trikes. Nike did their own internal study to compare injury risk. But the one thing they changed, they put a huge outsole on it as well. So the outsole, you couldn't wear it out before the midsole, more than likely. And it had to be because the previous version, that exposed foam was just too much of a return feature for Nike shoes, I would say.
That's awesome. One of my all-time favorite shoes actually had a drop through midsole and no outsole in the forefoot. It was the Lunar Eclipse. It's still one of my favorite shoes of all time. And it's it very much changes. Very much changes the experience of that run. So I ran my first half marathon in that shoe. It's still one of my favorites.
Did you wear the high top version of it? The high top knitted version of the Lunar, I think it was just the Lunar Trainer, I think. It was amazing. It was like a basketball shoe knitted one piece upper, but the midsole was the same. It was it was a fantastic shoe. I like the Lunar on midsole. It was quite a fun, I thought that was a good upgrade in midsoles.
Yeah, agree. We won't geek out too much on shoes.
Okay, I was just about to say to you, shoe geeks, when you say the model of the shoe, can you also say the brand of the shoe? Because 9 out of 10 people listening to this don't know what the hell you geeks are talking about.
Yeah, they were all Nike shoes. Those are all Nikes. Nike of...
They were Nike, yeah.
I figured that out because I used the Nike Flyknit Zoom 4 and I got about 1,000 Ks out of that shoe. Absolutely loved it. Try to replace it now. They don't have it anymore. I can't find it in stock. The 5 doesn't look the same, but I love that shoe.
That's actually a good point, I think. And I'd like your take on this, Nitto. Like historically, say with the 2050s or the 2070s, it was a pretty easy shopping trip for you and your parents at the time. It was kind of like, hey, I was in the 2070. Can I have the 2080? Can I have the 2090? These days, I would say that is probably the only thing you can be sure of is as failure is to just go and ask for the same model of the same shoe. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's fair to say. Like when I worked in retail as a student. So when I was as a podiatry student, I worked in one of the specialty retail shops and it was about 2005 and 2006. So online sales were happening, but people in Adelaide were scared of online sales. They weren't trusting them, that's for sure. So a person would come through the door, they knew what they wanted. And like a traditional ASICS wearer would come in and ask, like you said, the GT series. I've got the GT 21 series. Can I get a DS trainer for my faster running? They'd tuck two shoes under their armpits. They'd talk to you about their weekend running coming up. And they'd walk out the door and they wouldn't even try it on. They just knew what they needed. And that was like the consumer of like running. You just didn't buy shoes online. You went into the shop and buy it. Sales were easy back then. Whereas now the person that is utilizing retail or trying to connect themselves with the correct shoe have this perception that if you get into the wrong shoe, you're not going to be able to run. And the risk of injury is really, really high. There was a study back in 2012, I think, Sagittario, I think it was, saying that people's perception of footwear connected, getting your foot into the right shoe geometry was one of the most important things to reduce risk of injury, which we know now is definitely not as important, especially as a novice runner. There's so many more things you need to worry about as a novice runner to not get injured. Shoes, you probably can get yourself into the wrong shoe for the first wear and it not be as big a risk factor as, you know, training too hard too early and not getting your characteristics right. it must be very difficult now to sell a shoe in retail compared to what it was two decades ago, because you have one, so many options, two, the analysis is expected and the service is expected. But if you know what shoe you want now, some people are going online and just picking it up like they used to because they knew exactly what they needed to. Or they go into the shoe shop, and I heard a story the other day from Julian, one of the retailers, a co-host on Shoe Geek, say someone just walked into the shop, got fitted, went and bought the shoe online, took the service and went and bought it online because it was, you know, $40, $50 cheaper. And shoe sales 20 years ago, like, yeah, you just bought the previous model because they weren't that any different. Whereas now, well, the previous model is changing a lot now. Like, the biggest example of that was probably the Nimbus 24 to the Nimbus 25 or the Kayono 29 to the KO 30. The shoe was a dramatic change. I mean, they got rid of visible gel, they got rid of Duo Max, and they increased the stack height around about 30%. And suddenly the Nimbus looked a bit like a Hoka Clifton. So, yeah, so it was very different.
Fun story. I actually worked with Julian when I was in my medical school years. I worked at the running company Geelong with him when he wasn't the owner. He was him and Brie were working there. So I worked with both of them. It was a good time. I remember getting shopped like that. We used to call it getting shopped.
There you go.
Where somebody used to come in and and then do everything and then like go buy it online. It was it wasn't fun when that happened to you. But let's touch on something else, Nita. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I have a theory that, and you would remember barefoot running. It was, it still exists, of course, but you would remember like the first time barefoot running really got hyped. And
yeah.
The reason that came up was because there was groups of runners, particularly at Stanford, doing a bunch of time barefoot, right? And there was still a bit of and there's still some of these people who suggest, you know, you should spend some of your week barefoot. Yeah. And, you know, full disclosure, I think that's, you know, foot strength is a key. I love foot strength. I love spending time barefoot, etc. But back then, there was kind of this, you spent a period of your week barefoot. I have a theory that is now moving from a period of your week barefoot to a period of your week without super foams and plates. That's my take on this and where we're headed. I'd love your thoughts on things like the need for non-super foams, the need for spending time out of super shoes. Because, you know, we've seen people like Lionel Sanders who says, like, I'm no longer training in super shoes. Like, I'm not doing it. So what's your take here?
Look, mate, this is a whole podcast in itself, but it's a good one because it's a pretty open discussion and there's no consensus for it really, is there? I mean, you're right. So when we saw the big boom of 2009, 2010 in Adelaide, everything was a year delayed in Adelaide. But, you know, transitioning from a traditional shoe to reduce risk of injury, you went into a minimal base shoe. And, you know, if you transferred all your running load into a Vibram Five Fingers, your risk of metatarsal stress went up, but maybe your knee pain went down. So we knew just like the change of like shoe characteristic would alter things. Now we're in a phase where it's really hard to even find a traditional shoe day. That's probably half the problem, right? Every Monday last week, our summer, our athletics group would spend a bit of time doing drills and strides. And often I would suggest people try and run more minimalistic because the load was quite low. The whole idea is to create, you know, feel the ground, hit the ground hard, create your own stiffness profile, basically going over wickets, going over hurdles and things like that. And it was hard. Some of the group didn't even have minimalistic shoes anymore. Like, so they didn't have like, you know, traditional racing flats, and some went barefoot. A lot of guys went to spikes, but look, mate, this is a new spike. This is like the Adios, this is the Avanti TYL. That's a traditional racing flat. That's got like 20 mils of midsole in it now. So it's hard to find even spikes now that are minimalistic. So I guess the question is, what's the risk of wearing the super shoes all the time? And look, in 2019 in our clinic, at Sports and Arthritis Clinic, we saw over 20 proximal bone stress injuries in distance runners. So meaning a sacrum, a neck of femur, a proximal femur stress. And, you know, it wasn't obviously just the shoes that caused this, but when you wear these really high compliant foams, when you hit the ground, you know, the foam compresses, you land a little bit stiffer, you don't flex your knee quite as much. So the whole leg becomes like a little bit more of a straight line lever. So the load probably globally is a bit higher at hip level, but it may be a little bit lower at ankle level because the shoe has the rocker sole, you have the midsole. So you distribute the load a bit differently. And the one thing I would note, like when I started doing marathon training, there's no way I could handle like 1 hour tempos or even like half hour threshold type workouts in a traditional shoe. The limiting factor was how sore my calves were, but I can put this shoe on and I can handle half an hour in this, which means, you know, I can handle more dose of training. So perhaps I can collect a bit more physiology. which is a great benefit, and probably at the risk that maybe I can be a bit more catabolic metabolically, for example. I could probably distress things over a longer period of time and be a bit less aware of it. So maybe my injury risk profile changes a bit by wearing these shoes a little bit too often. My question, and it's open for you guys, is like, and we had this debate, like we see a lot of juniors now wearing super shoes. And we see them wearing them in workouts, in races. We see like an under 15 national final where all the kids, some of them wear Dragonflies, which is the traditional spike from Nike, but others will still wear Vaporflies. And they will still run just as fast over 1500 in a Vaporfly, if not faster, or in cross-country circuits. And, you know, we think about when I was younger, I was minimal shoes, developing stiffness characteristics and exposing myself to that. What's the risk of kids not doing that now compared to what it was, you know, historically? There's not as much available to them to wear traditional shoes for like running drills and sprints and strides. I don't know. I don't know the answer to it. But I think at the end of the day, similar to changing shoes for different impacts and loads, there probably does need to be, in terms of an injury resilience thing, changing or accommodating some of your shorter dose days and traditional shoes to be able to change your loading a little bit, but also developing some of your mechanical characteristics. Do we need to be going back to traditional shoes just for an element of our training to be able to increase our ceiling of like mechanical loading and things like that? I'm not 100% sure, but I'm sure there's answers. We see it all the time, you know. Even just watching a blog, Jake Weichmann, you know, one of the, he's a world champion 1500s, he doesn't like running in plated shoes. Now, I don't know if he's got a reason for that, but he's just not exposing himself to that. I don't know what it's like in the multi-sport world, like the elite triathletes, Dave, but I would assume at the end of the day, if you're running in shoes that are making you a little bit more economical, you probably have to run a little bit more training to be able to get more physiology. So, but you probably can.
Yeah, it's such a wicked problem, because you're talking about there's so many different parts to it. So there's the, like, as you say, the physiology or the cardiovascular load, right? That's part of it. Then you're talking about musculoskeletal load, but we're talking about that in different parts of the body. So are you worried about deloading a foot, or are you worried about loading up a knee, or are you worried about loading up a hip, and where is your injury history and what does that predispose you to? And then there's like global characteristics, and maybe the calf soreness you feel from wearing those minimalist shoes is protective because it stops you doing too much volume. Right. So it stops you progressing too quickly. So there's all sorts of aspects there. I mean, my bias is like kids shouldn't be in these, but that's a ridiculous foot strength bias. And that's also like saying kids shouldn't be on computers. They should learn to write with a pencil. But like, how relevant is that in 10 years when pencils don't exist? So but there's all sorts of biases I have that I need to sort of set aside here that I'm not sure are I'm not sure are super relevant, but it certainly, I am struggling at the moment to try and find non-plated, non-magic foam shoes to do my easy days in, because I've got a really niche. The things I like in shoes are very niche. I'm like polarized. I want a marshmallow or I want something super firm. So, you know, I love the Invincible, but I also love the Adios Pro 2.
Yep.
So like that's
Nike and Adidas.
For absolutely.
Everyone listening.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, Zyla.
Yeah.
I was going to say the last thing I wanted to touch on was just some shoe features. I think this is something that you are very good at and I think would help our listeners a lot, which is just certain features in a shoe that we should think about when it comes to like common injuries. So I'm thinking, you know, some knee pain or patellofemoral issues, maybe some plantar fascia issues and maybe some Achilles issues. Yep. Like what shoe should we be reaching for in our shoe quiver, in our collection of shoes? Or if we have a history of these things, what are some features we maybe look for?
Yeah, it's a good point. So look, I guess if we go back to just like looking at the anatomy of a shoe, and often the things people tend to talk about is, let's just use the midsole, like the heart of the shoe, the height of the rear foot versus the height at the forefoot. The relationship between the height of the back and the front is referred to as a pitch or a drop. So traditionally, most running shoes used to have a 10 mil heel pitch in it, which means the rear foot was 10 millimeters higher than the forefoot. And that was most shoes. I reckon most shoes about 8 millimeters now will sit between 6 and 10 millimeters as a normal drop. Some shoes have a bit of an ethos of having a zero drop shoe. So it means they've got the front of the shoe and the back of the shoe look pretty much the same. This is actually an example of a brand called Ultra. Ultra, this is actually a bit ironic, though. This is a 4 mil pitch shoe from Ultra. They moved away from zero drop shoes. Aesthetically on the film, if people look at it, it looks like they're sitting a much higher at the rear foot compared to the forefoot. But these are called sidewalls. They're a bit higher, but that's only got a 4 mil heel pitch. So when I run in this shoe, I don't feel the heel being elevated as much. And when we get to racing shoes, usually we find that the pitch of the shoe is probably closer to usually between probably 3 to 5 millimeters on average. So 4 mils, this is the Saucony Endorphin, the Endorphin Elite. And the back of the shoe is about 40 mils and the front of the shoe is about 36 mils. So the pitch has always been used to try and, you know, navigate some loading changes over time. We know that if the shoe has a higher pitch to it, so the rear foot is higher, that general population who run in that shoe might have higher patellofemoral loading or higher knee loading or maybe higher quadricep loading. And it makes sense. Your heel is closer to the ground. You probably enter into the ground a bit earlier. So you probably put the brakes on a touch more. Whereas if you wear a shoe that has lower heel pitch, so less of a drop, the forefoot's not too far away from the ground relative to the rear foot, you might strike slightly further forward towards the midfoot forefoot, which means the load goes towards the foot and the ankle. So it brings us to like this like bucket or umbrella of sort of like shoes that we use to try and treat different running related injuries. And you could almost group, you know, patellofemoral pain, patellotendinopathy, ITB syndrome is a common knot runner. With a shoe with has a bit less pitch to it, might be advantageous. It might promote you to run with a slightly higher cadence rate, but I'm not actually sure if shoe attributes really do change your training characteristics too much. But conversely, if someone has more like plantar fascia issues or Achilles issues or calf issues, a shoe that has a higher pitch built into it brings the ground up to the heel and probably generally offloads the posterior ankle and calf a little bit more. So to add a little bit more to it is that shoes now that come with a little bit of a rocker placed through the forefoot or a bit more toe spring, which is the measure of the top of the midsole, that sort of acts as a bit of a sagittal plane lever or a fulcrum, and that can also deload attributes of your plantar fascia, your Achilles and calf as well. And of course, the final thing is how the individual enters into the ground running stride-wise. People who forefoot strike might get more back from the rocker. They might not get as much back from the pitch because they are a bit more biased towards loading their calf and Achilles. So the rocker might be a good tool to manage posterior ankle pain for a forefoot runner. But in saying that, a heel striker would still use the fulcrum off the rocker in the forefoot. So that might be a useful tool to also offload. I usually find if someone has an Achilles or calf issue, a heel pitch plus a rocker in the forefoot seems to be a nice way to keep people running with deloading that anatomy. It doesn't stop load at that anatomy. It just reduces it a little bit, hopefully below the pain threshold.
Awesome. That's such a good, like, that's so succinct. You did that way better than I could have ever. I really appreciate that, Nitta. This has been so great. Really appreciated all your time, Nitta. It's been unreal.
No, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, and there's obviously these conversations can have a lot.
Well, I have two questions before we go. One is related to you, and one is a selfish one on my part.
I knew this one was coming. He doesn't like my answer, Nina, so he wants your answer.
No, it's just interest's sake. I've got comrades marathon coming up, 85 kilometers in 3 weeks. The numbers, the Essex numbers 26 that I bought, the Essex salesman told me there's no ways you should be doing comrades marathon in your Nike Alpha Fly 2s. No ways, no carbon shoes. You should be doing it in this numbers. Now I've done multiple Ironmans, multiple marathons in the Alpha Fly 1s. Absolutely love them. I've never had any issues with them. I did Two Oceans Ultra Marathon in them a few weeks ago, 56K, no problems whatsoever. Yep. I did the numbers. I did a 41K run last week in the numbers, and I got a blister on the side of my foot. I don't know if it was a combination of a new shoe, an old sock, yep, which I wore as an amateur. But I want to do comrades in the Nike Alpha Fly 2s because I love them. You know, I've never had issues with them. Should it be a personal intuitive decision like that? Because I've also watched other YouTube videos of coaches and the official comrades coach saying you shouldn't be running comrades in a super shoe like that. What is your take on that?
Look, you see people winning ultra marathons now wearing super shoes and things like that on undulating terrain. So it is a little bit intuitive. But the one thing I'll say is that when you look at all these economical studies, when you put the Vaporfly on or the Alphafly, you're probably moving with more ease at the pace you want to run comrades at. And if you were to do a study of how you're running at the end of comrades, for example, comparing it to, say, a shoe that's maybe a little bit more stable, maybe the benefit of the Alphafly is probably not quite the same as what it was at the first part of the marathon. But then you need to weigh up how much of a benefit was at the start of the marathon, the whole sum of the race, and was it more beneficial than wearing a Nimbus? Look, the Nimbus is pretty heavy as a shoe. And look, let's say, for example, let's just say the negative to a Nimbus is that it's too heavy and it's not going to give you too much back. And the Alpha Fly is super responsive and really fun, but maybe at the end of the race, you're a bit too sloppy to be wearing it. There are shoes that live between that as well. I mean, that's where these super trainers come into play. Like I said, I could probably wear this and be 2% more economical compared to a traditional shoe, but a little bit less economical in this shoe compared to an Alpha Fly. But the Super Blast might actually look after me at the end of Comrades pretty well. It doesn't weigh much. It's pretty stable. It has the same foam. Maybe that would be a shoe that you would tend to wear as a surrogate. But look, if you're running it's a road race for 80-odd kilometres, isn't it? So, look, whatever distracts you the best probably, you know, is probably the shoe for you. But I would probably suggest that it's probably something between those two shoes that probably works well. I reckon if you're running Comrades at, you know, 3:30 to 4-minute K pace, yeah, you still wear the Alpha Fly. And then the cohorts that run at, say, 6-minute K pace or 5:30 K pace for that whole distance or 5-minute K pace, look, they still get something from the super shoe. We know that from the evidence. But maybe the effect at the end of the shoe, at the end of the lifespan, might not be quite what it was at the start. That would be my advice. And maybe find a shoe between the two probably is the sweet spot. So just buy another shoe.
I was about to say I'm going out and getting the Super Blast, Asics Super Blast today, and David can't say a thing because a doctor told me to do it. my last selfish question. The question is related to you. You've got a 2:33 marathon. Is it true that you did that marathon on about 60 km of training a week?
Look, if you grab the whole data over the whole year, it was probably about 75 or 80 for the average. And I did get up to 120 km a week at some areas for Gold Coast for the marathon. The one beforehand, Adelaide, was closer to 80 or 90 km a week consistently leading into it. I don't come from a background of running a lot of endurance. So I found that, you know, if I collect an easy run over 90 minutes or a tempo over 80 minutes, for example, I feel pretty cooked at the end of both of them. I don't think I metabolize fats that well from not much history of doing it. So I reckon that large durations of running for me seem to be a bit of a risk factor. So I can handle a little bit more quality of running and run okay. But in saying that, the best, if I was going to run under 2:30 for the marathon, which, you know, that day I did fall to pieces at the end. I struggled with the heat of Gold Coast. I should have run more volume. I should have been a bit slower in intensity workouts and handled more dose as well. So I did bike ride though, maybe. Look, I think that's probably a big thing. So I probably substituted 3 to 4 hours a week bike riding. So I could collect a lot of that sort of, you know, moderate to high, say low, like upper end aerobic based work on the bike with not too much musculoskeletal soreness. And I've got such a vertically oscillating gait. So I think perhaps maybe the longer runs I'd still be bouncy. So I'd still have calf soreness, Achilles soreness from longer durations of running. So I think I need more time to develop more volume, but there's, you know, more volume usually is associated to a better marathon. So if I want to break 2:30, I need to be consistently closer to that 120, 130 Ks a week. So I don't advocate the way that I train. I do it because I physiologically can't handle the mileage I want to handle.
It's a really good answer. Awesome, Nitta. This has been so great. Really appreciate you. Appreciate your time. And yeah, it's been so great. So really, you know, cool. I'm sure the listeners will get a lot out of this. And yeah, we just appreciate you, mate. Thank you.
No, really, really glad to do it today. Good chat.
David, thank you so much for organizing Nitta, man. I mean, I shouldn't be saying this, but when we stopped recording, we kept talking and I kept badgering him with selfish questions, and his insight is just so valuable.
Yeah, he's like an encyclopedia of footwear and shoes and stuff. Like, it's what he does all day, every day between runners. And I mean, he runs, he coaches, and he treats runners. And like, it's just that, and he researches in the space. It's just like in that niche, it's what he does. It's what he breathes. So, you know, for a while I wouldn't say at that level, but I was certainly more similar, but I've just lost touch because I'm just not doing it as much. And he is, and it's just so good to have his insights. I really appreciate his time.
What was he talking about in terms of the study that they were doing at the park run and characteristics of runners, etc.? And, you know, I was very interested in what he was talking about, like where you're at in your running journey and the volume versus the intensity and all of that. And like, and it's all to do with like injury prevention.
Yeah, well, it's probably less about injury prevention and more injury risk. So it's probably the flip side of that. So it's like, what is injuring runners? And it's hard. Like that sort of study is very difficult. But basically what it looks like is when people start running, they don't run as much and they run more similar in intensity. Each run is more similar. And it's generally like probably around threshold pace for, like, you know, whatever that is, or uncomfortably hard or comfortably hard, somewhere there. They finish every run, they're sweating, they're tired, they feel great, right? That's how most people run. If they're running 2 to 3 5Ks a week, that's probably how they run. Get out the door, run as hard as they can for that distance, and then they're done. As they progress through their running journey, eventually they start to run more volume, they start to run more easy running, because as I said in the podcast, like, there's kind of a ceiling for how much hard running you can do. You can kind of run hard 3 days a week or so, and you can do about, you know, if you're really elite, maybe that's up to 30Ks. For the rest of us, maybe it's less than that, you know. So what I'm getting at is there's kind of a bit of a ceiling to this, and people tend to approach the high intensity as the priority, and then they build the easy stuff around that. That's kind of how the running journey goes for people. And I mean, most answers, and I don't like this because this is me changing my mind on something, because when I started running, I didn't believe in this, but now it's becoming more and more apparent. Like, most answers lead to more volume. It's an uncomfortable, unpopular truth, or maybe not truth, but theory at least at this stage, which is kind of, if you want more durability, got to run. You want to burn more fat and be more efficient, got to run more. You want to be a better runner, probably got to run more.
But that's the boring part, because it takes patience and a lot of slower running. It's so boring. Exactly. And people don't have that patience sometimes.
Exactly. And that's one of the challenges I would say is, like, when you're starting out running, your load tolerance isn't high. Running 15 kilometers a week, like, another kilometer is a significant portion of that. By the time you're at, you know, 120 kilometers a week, you can add another 10 kilometers and it's not as big a deal. So what I'm getting at is your ability to tolerate load is a lot less when you're starting out. And I think that's kind of where the sort of research has ended up, and what sort of Nita was saying is kind of your load tolerance goes up over time as you, you know, collect more stuff, and being careful with intensity in the early phases is probably more what we need to be seeing and more what we need to be doing, because that, you know, that's part of the injury risk there.
The four F's of footwear, can you remind me what those are?
Yeah, so Nino didn't touch on this. This is a way that I think about things, and I used to talk about things. He talked about function first, which I think is probably not a bad way to go about it. I talk about fit first. The reason I talk about fit first is because it doesn't matter if that's a racing shoe. If it doesn't fit your foot, it doesn't matter. Right? So it's kind of like the four Fs are really fit and function as the first two. And that function is really about, like, what is it for? Right? Then there's feel. And I would say that the shoe needs to feel good. And we talked a lot about that. Nita talks about fun shoes. He talks about resilience. I said it, I've got a really niche thing of what I like. And then the very last one, which is like a far fourth, well down the track, is fashion. So if all other things are the same, you can choose on fashion, but the other three variables should be how you choose your shoe, really, the other three Fs.
Talking about function, like, really, really good questions in terms of how do you choose your first shoe if you're going to choose a second shoe. And it seemed to me like that second shoe is like a bigger decision because you have more choice. And if you're not going to get a third or fourth shoe, that second shoe is quite an interesting one to choose.
Yeah, I think it depends on runner archetype. So if you are somebody who's running hard 3 times a week or 4 times a week or easy, like, if there's not a lot of difference in your training, firstly, I'd say probably bring some difference in your training, right, in terms of intensities and durations. But if you're not going to do that and you're buying a second shoe, there are really two ways to go about it. There's buy a very different shoe so that you start to bring some difference in. Hey, I want to run fast once a week, I'm going to buy a shoe for that. Or I want to run long once a week, I'm going to buy a shoe for that. Or what he was suggesting, which is, it maybe it's the same shoe, so you have two pairs of the Nimbus or two pairs of the Superblast. Or it's two very similar shoes. So maybe the Superblast and then the Mizuno he pulled out, so that you can sort of have two similar shoes and you alternate between them, because there is some suggestion that alternating shoes, even if it's the same model, may have some benefits to injury risk. I would also say the same goes for surface, because it's really not just about the shoe. It's about the shoe and your body, which, and your body doesn't change much, but it's the shoe, the body, and the surface you're on. And so if you can, you know, mix up your surfaces and mix up the shoes, that'd be super helpful.
Thank you once again to Nita for coming on. Absolutely. Look, I think we should get him on back on to talk about coaching and running and training, etc., because I actually heard him on another podcast and his insight there too is insane.
Yeah, I mean, he's coaching some very good young distance runners and middle distance runners particularly, and he's got some really good philosophies around that. And I think he's trained at a high level for that sort of, he called them long sprints. I mean, that's very generous for an 800 meters. That is not a long sprint. That is just torture. But, you know, he's done some of that training. He's also done marathon training. So he's got a really good perspective on it all. And obviously said, clinically, research, all that stuff.
Before we go, this month's 1% Better Challenge is for you to train naked. Every month we have a challenge to make ourselves as a community better. And this month's challenge is Training with no watch, no head unit, no form of data. You're a big fan of this, aren't you?
I think it's just, it's the, Ned is a good example, so am I. We started running without GPS watches. I talked about this last episode, but as a result, your feel, you start to change how you feel things. And I think there's a generation of people who've never trained without GPS watches now. And I wonder if they are losing a talent or an intuition or a thing that's very important. So we talked on this episode about evolution and, you know, the pencil thing and the analogy I use there with the super shoes. But I think this is still valuable because your tech is not always going to work. My second marathon, my GPS dropped out and wouldn't connect because I was in not even that rural Australia, but it was a thing. So how do you then run a marathon when you've got no data? You've done all your training with data and now you've got no data. So like, how do you do that? What's the right intensity? How do you know? Right. So I guess what I'm getting at is your technology is not always going to work. Sometimes you have to sit and charge it for 2 hours while you're at your computer, sitting in your cycling gear as you did midweek, Zylan. So it's certainly something you should think about, like riding without stuff to see how, or running without stuff, cover it up, whatever you need to do to make yourself feel there, but don't have the data available to you at all times.
In this big Comrades Marathon training block I've done, I have 90% of the time not looked at my watch on all of the runs, and I've gotten so good that I can tell you what pace I'm running at just according to feel now. It's incredible. And I remember once I produced a film for Ironman, for the Ironman 70.3 World Championships that was happening in my town in 2018, and I had to go to Stellenbosch to film James Cunnamer, one of the favorites for the race, professional triathlete, and I filmed him at 5:30 in the morning at a swimming pool. He got out of the pool and I said, James, I noticed you're not wearing a watch. Like, how do you know how far you've swum? Because for me, it's like, I want to know, did I swim 2Ks or 4Ks? And he said, who cares? I swam an hour. It was intense with the Stellenbosch swimming squad here. Who cares how far it is? Like, it's an hour, give or take. He went on to win Ironman France, I think, not so long after that. So, yeah, that always stood out to me. And I remembered that because he was one of the premier professional triathletes in the world at the time, and here was a guy training with absolutely no watch. So just goes to show. David, thank you so much for producing this and getting us together to put this on. Really appreciate your work, and yeah, we'll see you on the next one.
Appreciate you, mate. Thank you.